Welcome to the Foolish Adventure Show, where guru hype is banned, lifetime value of a customer is king, and the internet business has replaced the J-O-B as the path to financial success and personal freedom. Now, here's straight talk about making a living online with your host, Tim Conley.
Welcome to another episode of the Foolish Adventure Show. I'm your host, Tim Conley, and I've got a very fantastic guest on today. This guy has done over 700 interviews with ambitious upstarts and freedom fighters. He had built a company with his brother that hit sales of nearly $39 million and then sold that company. He briefly retired and then jumped back into the fray by creating an interview show called Mixergy. That's, I'm totally messing this up.
It's for the ambitious upstart. What you're trying to say is this is an interview program that I do for people who are so freaking driven that instead of just relaxing and enjoying the drive into work, they have to listen to an entrepreneur talk about how to build a business. They're so freaking driven that many of them will, before they go to sleep, listen to one of these interviews so that in their dreams, they could dream about building successful companies.
Now, that was an awesome introduction. Love that. Because this is a consummate professional, Mr. Andrew Warner. What's up?
Good to see you. And by the way, so freaking driven is maybe a problem on your interview program, because as we were talking before, you said, Andrew, I like to have a dialogue and I like to, you know, not have it be overstructured. And we're recording this via audio, but you and I can see each other. And as you can see, I wrote down in my notes, no structure, dialogue. I am so freaking anal and so freaking determined to get everything right that I even wrote that down without paying attention.
Yeah, structuring the no structure. I love that.
I always want to know, what do I need to do to make this the best possible whatever it is? So if I'm doing an interview with you, how do I really knock Tim's socks off? How do I really make it so that everyone in his audience remembers this interview more than anyone else?
Yeah, so how is it that I mess up my introduction? Well, I'm actually, for the very first time, looking at the person I'm talking to out of doing all these shows. So it's quite unnerving to actually perform and then getting watched at the exact same time.
Suggest to you that you might want to do this in the future. And the reason you want to do it is because you want to ask people the tough questions. And the way to know if you're at the right moment in the interview where you can ask the tough questions is to actually see their expression, to maybe launch a few sample questions to see, hey, did I just shake him up a little bit? Is this a little too far for him? Is he gonna be receptive to this? And the only way you could do it is by looking them in the eyes. And so if I'm gonna ask someone a question like, when did you lose your virginity and how much of an impact that have on your drive, I want to ask him a few sample questions ahead of time and see where his eyes go, to see if he's okay with it, to see if he's smiling when I ask him about not being able to get a date, to see if he feels like, oh, I'm so angry, so that I can, you know, tap into that. And by watching them in the interview, you can tell that. The video isn't for the audience. I don't know why anyone in the audience would want to watch just a couple of heads talking. It's for us to just gauge, are we ready to ask that other person that really that powerful question that's going to be the most memorable question of the interview.
That's interesting. That's very interesting, because I listen to the Mixergy show. I have it on my phone, take it around as I'm walking my dog. I'll listen to the interviews. I think I've watched maybe two out of, 700 and something interviews. So out of all those interviews, I've watched maybe two of them. Because I love to just get the voices inside my head, kind of replaces the ones that are already there. But let's get into this. Let's get into this talk. So you and I actually have something in common, and that is beyond just being entrepreneurs. You and I discovered at an early age the power and joy of the markup. We learned that you could buy stuff at the store, break it apart, and sell it to other people for a profit.
Right.
Can you tell me a bit about that? I want to hear your experience as being that kid. Why did you do it, and what drove you to do it?
You know what? It was just fun. The idea that you can buy a pack of 10 pieces of gum and buy for 50 cents, sell it for 10 cents each, and double your money is exciting. That's fun to me. And I feel like there are a handful of people on this planet to whom that is outrageously exciting. For everyone else, that just sounds like a boring childhood. But for the people who that speaks to, I feel like by expressing it, we're telling them, hey, you're not crazy. That is a great way to live. And I wish that someone would have said that to me when I was growing up.
Yeah, I did it. I grew up in a very... let's just call it what it was. We were dirt poor, so I didn't have any money. Like, my parents could not buy me stuff. And Star Wars came out when I was a kid, so I wanted all the Star Wars I could get. So Star Wars trading cards were huge, and I would go up to the store because I was one of the few kids in my town who was allowed to walk to the store, which was only a few blocks away from like all the other kids in the neighborhood. I could walk up there by myself, buy stuff, and then I would take it to grade school, which was, again, just a few blocks away in a small town. And I would break up that pack of Star Wars cards, and I would trade them off for Matchbox cars. I would sell the gum that came, that little nasty stick of gum that comes with all packs of cards of everything. I would sell that even.
That wasn't it. That meant you had to use your dirty little kid hands to hand it over to the person who bought it after you probably had it in your dirty little kid hands for a few days.
Yeah, you know, kids didn't care about that stuff. But I would trade that, and then I'd get the Matchbox cars, and then I would trade those up till I could get my Star Wars action figures, and I would move my way up, and then eventually when I was done with those, I would then sell those for cash and start the whole process over again.
See, for me, as you're telling me that, I was trying to think of what I wanted to buy with my money, and there was never anything I really wanted to buy with it. For me, it was just about points. I'm really bad at understanding what's better than something else unless there's a clear number attached to it. So I don't know if this shirt that I'm wearing right now is better than the shirt that I put on earlier. The only reason that I put the other shirt on earlier when I thought you might want to do this via video was there were buttons on it. In my mind, shirts with buttons look better than shirts without. You know, they're like
they're classy.
But if there's no clear analytical way to evaluate, I'm just lost. I can't really tell. So I wouldn't know if I was more interested in one toy or another. In fact, I probably wasn't. What I was interested in was just the sheer numbers. How many pieces of gum can I sell? How much money could I have in the bank? And I hate to say it, but to this day, that is true of me, that I still like to just, more than anything else, see how much money's in the bank every day. I'm whispering it because I'm a little... I was at one point carried away with reading about J.P. Getty, the oil man, who became the richest man in the world for a while. And in one of the books, I read that before he went to sleep every night, he liked to look at his ledger book to see how much money he was bringing in from all his different oil businesses. And on that same ledger book included how much he spent on a sandwich. So it would be like a 5-cent sandwich in a multi-million dollar ledger book. But that's how much he got off on just looking at his numbers, and what a sense of safety he must have gotten at looking at that before going to sleep. I can imagine.
Well, Rockefeller did the same thing, and he ingrained that into his kids. He goes into how he did that as even as a young man, and then got a job as a bookkeeper, and then eventually started working his way up. All because he felt that he kept track of every single penny. And he taught that to his kids, made his kids, even when he was immensely wealthy, his children had to keep a ledger to the penny of what they got, what they spent, and because he felt it was very important to keep track of all that. I wish I had been that diligent.
Like, today, if you say that, I'm sure that people would think, that's the wrong message to send to kids. You shouldn't send them the message that money is important. And, you know, meanwhile, of course money is important. And of course they should be taught that. And I'm not saying only teach them that and not give them any time to go play and not give them any time to express themselves. But I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I used to keep my own little ledger book as a kid. It's great for when you're an adult.
I wish I would have done that. I wish I would have actually kept better track, because for me, it was all about the game. And you know, I wanted to accumulate the things that I desired, And I saw that commerce was the fastest way to get there, that I could take things like grab all these bottles back when soda was actually in bottles and take that up to the store and cash that in. And then that was my seed capital.
You mean the glass? Back when they had
back when glass bottles, and you'd get 10 cents for them with the deposits. You know, it was fantastic. It was like easy money. So I would pull up the wagon up to the store, cash those in, and then that was my seed capital. That taught me how to actually engage with the world on my terms. You know, because when you're a kid, everything is on everyone else's terms. Your teachers tell you what to do. Your parents tell you what to do. Everybody's telling you what to do. But when I would go and cash in my chips, when I would do that, that gave me control over my environment. That was a lesson that I've carried since then. And I see every entrepreneur I've ever run into, they truly believe they can change their environment.
You know what? Yes, there's that, this feeling of omnipotence over our own world and even other people's worlds. And that's what makes us feel like we can go out there and create something that never existed before that other people will want to pay for. And at the same time, there's this sense of deep insecurity I feel for entrepreneurs. The sense that I can change the world is counteracted by the sense that maybe what I'm doing isn't big enough. Maybe what I'm doing isn't right, you know?
Yes, I've always felt that. And sometimes I try to determine whether that was like my upbringing, you know, nurture versus nature. But every entrepreneur that I've ever run into always feels they have something to prove. I don't know the specifics, you know, because I usually don't try to pry. But we do have that sense of insecurity. Like,
I try to pry. So let me ask you this.
Okay.
You're doing this program with a sheet behind you to uh-huh. muffle the sound, with just Skype to record it. Do you ever feel like, what the hell am I doing? Why am I not on the radio? Or is it really significant if I don't have millions of people who are watching or listening to this? Do you ever feel like maybe this is too small time?
No, because I see the future, and I always look at that. I don't see today. I see what the future is going to be. So why do I do this? Why do I do it the way I'm doing it? Because one, I'm lazy, and setting up a whole studio, which is my intent. My wife and I, we got this house, and I was going to have, like, there's a room in the house that's going to turn into like a whole studio and everything. And I found that the best acoustics in the entire home is inside my walk-in closet. And I'm like, okay, that's perfect, because it keeps, because my wife, she works from home. My daughter's homeschooled, so she's in another part of the house. My dog, which walks in and out of here periodically, they all make a bit of noise. And I found that this is the perfect place for me to create an audio recording. And no, being that it's audio, no one knows what it looks like in here.
Until I reveal
until it. Until you've come along, right?
But you know what? I feel that way. I feel that way all the time. I feel both, man, I'm doing the greatest thing I've ever done in my life, and I can see where this is going, and I'm really excited about it. And whenever someone has another idea for me, I just want to push it away because I feel like they don't see how big this is and how important it is. But at the same time, I'm feeling like, what the hell? Audience too small. I need a bigger audience. The impact is too little. I'm meant for greater things than this. I mean, I'm even as I'm talking to you, I'm thinking, well, I started off by saying this should be a great interview, but am I really bringing up a great interview? Probably not. All I've talked about so far is selling candy as a kid. Well, wow, wow, wow. How many other people tried to sell candy as kids? And what the hell? I want it to be bigger. I want every freaking thing to be bigger. I want it to
be
great.
The fact that we brought up the humanness of being entrepreneurs, because if you ever, everything in the media is all about how freaking awesome entrepreneurs are, only when they're succeeding, right? And then how horrible they are. The dichotomy is the only thing you ever get to see, the fantastic and the horrible. You never get to see the human.
is a brilliant genius who at 20-something was able to build this site that changed the world and the way that people connect with each other and is so dominant no one will ever take it down. The next day, he's a fool for having a stock go down and for not anticipating that the markets would do this and that. You're right. It is always really a very bipolar reporting.
Right, right. And so no one knows that the reality of being an entrepreneur isn't all glamour or all tragedy. There is this humanness that goes about being an entrepreneur. We suffer insecurities. We want to be playing on a bigger field. We're never content with what we have.
Okay.
I think that is critically important for anyone who is wanting to start a business that has never or has been doing it for a while and they feel like, I'm hating myself right now. This isn't what I wanted. This isn't what I thought it was going to be like. And then if they can see that somebody as successful as Andrew Warner can come in and say, yeah, I'm insecure. I'm discontent with where I'm at right now. You may see a certain level of success, but all I see is the lack, the potential that I'm missing out on, this bigger playing field that I'm not there yet. And I think a lot of people need to hear that.
Yeah, I think so too, especially if they see the fire that comes from that I am so freaking fired up because of this feeling that I'm not where I want to be, that it keeps me going, that it never lets me settle in and be comfortable.
Right, right. And I that may be a condition of being an entrepreneur, that we're never content with what we're doing, because we see how our environment can be manipulated, so we're always wanting to manipulate it. We're always, okay, so I've achieved this goal. We tend to be goal-oriented, so we've achieved the goal. Now what? I'm stronger now. I've achieved something, so I'm stronger now. That means I can do something bigger, and I can play on a bigger playing field. For you, what is that bigger playing field? You say you want a bigger audience, but what does that even mean?
You know what, actually, it's not so much the bigger audience. I think I need to have a clearer message that comes out of all the interviews that I've had, and I need to be able to take it out to the world and see some people get results, and then grow that base, the base of people whose lives are improved because of this understanding that I pulled out of my interviews and evangelized to them. I mean, one of the people whose work I admire right now is Eric Ries. Look at how many companies are shaped by his lean startup philosophy of don't go big, start with a small idea, test by changing your marketing before you change your product, and then if the marketing works, then build the product that the marketing promoted. I can't tell you how many startups I hear talk about how their lives are changed by that. Or Dale Carnegie, whose How to Win Friends and Influence People book shaped me years after the guy was dead. And you know, I want to have that kind of impact too. That's the part that pisses me off. That's the part that really frustrates me. And then as far as audience, I think that could come later on. And yeah, I don't want to just be talking to a small group of internet people. I want to stir things up. I believe that if done right, entrepreneurship and business can be as exciting to watch and listen to as pop culture TV shows and music. And I think that's where it needs to go. That's where my work needs to go. And I'll consider myself a failure, I think, unless I get there.
Okay, that's interesting. So the Mixergy version of Shark Tank or The Apprentice, a lot of those are so scripted that they're not really reality. So how do you see business as being a reality show?
I wouldn't even say a reality show, but I think about what is it that we watch. What is it that we watch when we show each other YouTube videos? They're YouTube videos of comics who are standing up and telling jokes, or they're YouTube videos of people who get hit in the nuts. I'd love to make it so that, and this is just me brainstorming here, but I don't see why people shouldn't be watching inspiring entrepreneurs in those small clips. I don't see why they shouldn't be listening to inspiring business stories instead of Lady Gaga when they listen on their MP3 player.
We entrepreneurs are pretty boring people because we're so busy doing what we do. Our lives are just normal. People don't realize. My daughter did this recently. She was saying how boring her mother and her father were. And we're like, really? We're boring to you. And she's like, yes, you guys are boring. My friend's parents are so much cooler than you guys. And like, okay, so explain that to us. Your mother races horses, endurance horses. So she's got a couple of Arabian horses. So she goes out and races those 50 miles, 100 mile races. So that's boring? Yes, that's boring. And for me, I consult with companies around the world. I do a podcast that I get to talk to very smart people like you. And to everyone else, that may seem a bit exciting, but when you're living it, like my daughter just lives this life, it's extremely boring. So how do you tell the entrepreneur's story so that it's exciting, that people will stay glued to it?
I need to get better at it, but one thing I do is not allow it to go the way that you do. I got to be honest with you and say, I cannot deal with no structure, just hanging out, because there's no way to tell if the interview is going to be good or not. There's no way to tell if you've gotten that part out. So I structure the hell out of my interviews to the extent that an interviewee will let me. And the more and more credibility I get, the more people will allow me to. But I believe that we have to look at the formula of the most successes, the format of the most interesting movies and books, and use those to tell the stories of the entrepreneurs who we have on our programs. And so for me and for the team at Mixergy, what we use is the hero's journey, which Joseph Campbell talked about, which Nancy Duarte talks about, which is you see an average person whose life maybe stinks a little bit, who is called to something greater, who goes out on a mission to accomplish it, who along the way has setbacks and in the end triumphs. And that is the story of that's the format of the most inspiring stories in history. And so that's the way I try to do it. I try to have an entrepreneur come on and say, like, here's how I would tell the Mixergy story, the Andrew Warner story. I'd say, Andrew, I'll just tell it. I started out with these great visions, but I was living off of $1 vegetable fried rice meals from the Chinese place because I couldn't afford any more than that. And as a guy who read about successful people growing up to live like that, where I couldn't even afford good food, was devastating. It made me feel ashamed to go out with my friends. When they'd invite me out, I would feel embarrassed to even go with them, not because they would judge me, but because I would judge myself in comparison to the people who I wanted to be like. And so I started a business with my brother, and we started this online email business. It did okay, but people stopped getting excited about getting email in their inbox. And so we found ourselves not earning as much as we thought. We were earning less than minimum wage. And it was inspiring at first, and then heartbreaking when we were earning less than minimum wage. And so we tried a bunch of different ideas. And then one of them, online greeting cards, just freaking took off. And the day it took off, you know, we were powering greeting card sites, and then we were working with outside greeting card makers to give them the software. And the day took off, I remember this woman who was working with us sent us so much traffic that I called her up to see if she was a fake. And I said, tell me about your greeting card site. And she started talking about Jesus and God and all these things. And I said, this woman might be scamming me. And I just kept pushing because I wanted to make sure that this was real, that I finally made it. And it turns out she was real. And from there, these guys who could not even afford real Chinese food ended up bringing in first, I remember, $100,000, then hundreds of thousands of dollars. Then can you imagine the first time I saw $1 million in my bank account? And it was, life was freaking great. And then you understand where I'm going with this. Right. Should I continue with the story?
No, okay. I think that actually gets us deeper into this talk. When I did a bit of research on you, I saw that one of the bits of advice that you had given in the past was to take money off the table. And so a lot of people, they get addicted to the struggle of building their business. They never get to enjoy the rewards of their business because they just stay addicted to the struggle. And one of the bits of advice that you had given was to take some money off the table. So what did you do in that process? How were you taking money out of your company?
you know what? I actually didn't take any money off the table. I didn't even pay off my credit card debt. I had something personally like $70,000 worth of debt, and I intentionally didn't pay it off or take enough of a salary to pay it off because I wanted to be fired up. I wanted every month to have to sit down and figure out how I can take money from one credit card and pay off another so that I would always be in this hungry mentality. And then when the market crashed and my advertisers couldn't afford to pay the bills, I found myself getting depressed because here I was, a guy who only worked towards seeing more money in his income statement month day to day, suddenly was seeing less day to day and then week to week, and then the streak went for months. And so I got down, and I just didn't have the energy to continue the way that I had. And I finally found a way out. I sold pieces of the business and then took and basically sold the whole business in pieces and just took off. And I took off because I wanted to rejuvenate myself. And what I discovered was I had to find something other than business to be excited about. I had to learn that there were other things like running, that there were other things like connecting with people, like dating, so that if business ever went down, I could, you know, have something else that was good in my life. I can also experience the rest of life. And that's where and in order to do that, I had to actually cash out a little bit and go and travel and disconnect from my old self and find my new self.
Yeah, I think that's the tale I've been trying to tell with the Foolish Adventure Show, is that entrepreneurship should be there to support your life and the vision that you have for life, as opposed to your life supporting your business.
That I have to be honest with you. And first of all, I love that you push me on this, and I love this dialogue. So don't take it wrong that I'm pushing back on you, but I can't deal with that. I cannot personally accept that my work is just so I can go home and kiss my wife and prepare to have kids and then take them to Little League. That is not a life that I can stomach. And we're going to have kids and we're going to have a family, and I'm looking forward to that. But I do not want that ordinariness. I want to scream out to the world and say, I am freaking here, and there's something different in me than there is in everyone else. And it's so good that the rest of the world can benefit from hearing it. And if it's not good, I want to be honest with myself and build that internal whatever essence so that it is so good that the rest of the world needs to be changed by it. But that to me is a life worth living. When I interview entrepreneurs who tell me about how they're happy to have a lifestyle business that kicks off, I don't know, anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000 a month in revenue, I could get it, and I want to learn from them, but I don't get inspired by it. I don't feel at the end of the day, at the end of their lives, that it's a life worth living. What the frick? What the hell's the point?
Well, and I think that's a difference in semantics between us, because I agree with you. Even as a child, I told my parents, I don't want to be normal. I do not want to have a normal life. I do not want to grow up to have, you know, the basic home in the suburbs and have the couple of cars and the 2.5 kids. You know, it's like, I don't want the normal life that everyone else leads. What I want is a life of adventure. I want to go out and I want to see this beautiful big world that we have, that we get the pleasure to live on. And I wanted to be able to do that. But I also have always felt that I could achieve bigger and better things, and I could reach out and do a lot more. So when I say about a person's life, they're the ones defining it. It could be somebody who just wants to make enough money to be able to have a comfortable life with their family, with their 2.5 kids and their couple of dogs. You know, that's fine for them.
Good for them, and I encourage people to live their lives any way they want. If you want to even be an ascetic and just disconnect from the world, terrific. I just don't get it. I don't get the lack of ambition to say, Steve Jobs just changed the way people interact with each other. There's a little bit of that kind of greatness in me. I don't get the we were just at the Library of Congress, Olivia and I, and we saw all these different books that change people's lives to this day. People are walking around saying, oh, I want to read that book, or oh, that book changed my life over there. I don't get walking through it and saying, that book changed my life, without saying at the same time, my book should be in here, or my story, or my movement, or my impact on the world should be just as big. And that part I just don't get.
Since I'm sitting here, and you do this in all your interviews, there's this big stack of books behind you. I'm an avid reader. Now most of my books show up on a Kindle, so I couldn't have a big stack of Kindles behind me. But what I'm noticing is that a lot of the books that are being generated out there are they're fluff pieces. They're marketing pieces. They're not actually trying to change the world.
Can we curse here?
Yeah.
Because they're abso-frickin-lutely bullshit. I see people write these books all the time. They come to me with them because they want to be interviewed, and they're absolute bullshit. It's just like you said. It's a brochure so that they could go out there and get speaking opportunities. And there's no substance to them. There's no change in them. There's just nothing.
Right. And I see that as a lack of vision. For some people that listen to the Foolish Adventure Show, they want a specific kind of life. They don't want to play on a big field. But there is a segment of my listenership that I know does. They want to experience life to the fullest. And that includes building something grander than themselves. And I think entrepreneurs that stick at it, that truly believe in entrepreneurship, do that. They end up trying to build something much grander than themselves. Part of it's the ego. You know, we want stuff to outlast us. It's like, yeah, I would love to have my book sitting right next to Thomas Jefferson's letters, right? We have that ego. So let's put that in actionable terms then. It's great for us to sit here and talk about, well, this is what we'd love to have. Well, how can someone do that if they've got an idea for something bigger? What do they do?
First of all, I think it's important to recognize that we want to do that and that it's okay to do it, because really in this world, we're not supposed to want that. In this world, we're supposed to be humble. In this world, we're not supposed to admit that we want greatness. And frankly, we're a little bit scared to admit it too. I'm a little bit scared to be as open as I am here in this interview, because I'm going to go home at night and, you know, sleep and wake up in the middle of the night, because that's the way I worry. In the middle of the night, I'll wake up and I'll go, why did I have to tell Tim and his audience that I aspire to all these great things? Because first of all, I might come across as a kook. And second, in 10 years, if I'm tired, it's going to feel like a burden that I can't succeed at this mission that I told the world I have. And it's not even a clear enough mission yet and all that stuff. And it's just going to go through my freaking head and it's going to work. I think we have to just get past that. We have to accept that that's part of the process. We have to be willing to stand up and say, I want something greater. And if other people laugh at us and if we're insecure about it, we have to just accept that. And I think that's really important. And I say, in this world, we're not supposed to believe that. It's true. We're supposed to really be humble. We're supposed to accept life. We're supposed to just enjoy ourselves. We're supposed to, you know, be less egotistical. I don't want that.
I'm fully on board with that. That's why the show's named The Foolish Adventure Show. It's for all those people out there that everyone around them told them that what you're doing is completely foolish. You should not go after your dreams. Do the realistic thing. Do the thing that is expected of you, because that is the way to be liked by other people. That's the way to have a successful life, is to just do what everyone else around you is doing. And I wanted to be able to have a way to reach out to people and say, it's okay. It's okay to be foolish. It's okay to let people make fun of you. Let people say that what you're doing is ridiculous. Let them stay small. But you do not have to be limited by their limiting beliefs. You can break free from their beliefs and create the life that you want and have the impact on the world that you would like to have. Not just like to have, but think is immensely necessary for the world. That's what I hope to achieve.
That's it.
You know, I was going to go into a whole bunch of other stuff about business, but I really like just that. Like this tale of giving permission to people, giving permission for people to be entrepreneurs, to do their lives. So can you give us some words of wisdom here at the end for all those who are struggling in their business, even those who are succeeding in their business? What could you tell them?
That it's worth it. That it sometimes feels like it's not worth it. I remember there were times when I said, well, why don't I just enjoy a simple life and get a job like the kind I had in college and, you know, earn a little bit more and not take the risks and not go to bed at night worried that I'm going to lose it all and not go to bed at night thinking that I'm going to fail at this business and my friends will laugh at me. And I thought and I was questioning whether it was worth it. And I can tell you that when I finally did have money and I was able to travel, I can see that it was worth it. When I was able to say, hey, I would love to go to run with the Bulls in Pamplona, and I was able to just go and do it, I can tell you that it was worth it. When I was able to go to Vegas and plunk down $10,000, $20,000 bets, I could feel like that's fully living life. When I was able to say, hey, I've got this idea for another business and I could afford to do it, it was worth it to just go out there, not wait for some investor to give me a permission slip or a boss to give me a little bit of flexibility with my time so I can do it. When I was able to say, hey, you know what? I'd like to go to Argentina and live in Argentina for a while and work from there. It was worth it that I didn't have to ask permission and didn't have to think about budgeting and how do I make it work. And I didn't have to think, well, who can take my dog and cat because it's expensive to bring them to. It's worth it to just say, okay, we'll make it work. It's not an issue. It's worth it. And it's worth it to know, frankly, all beyond money, that there are people who are impacted by this. I remember even before Mixergy had any revenue source, I would get emails from people who told me, Andrew, my life was changed because of this. Andrew, I was able to use what I learned in one of your interviews. And that just kept me going. And I love money. And I also love to have that kind of an impact on the world. And that is worth it. It's worth fighting for. It's worth risking everything for. It's worth dreaming big for and having other people say, what an idiot.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Before we end, I've got to ask, out of between you and your brother, who was Bradford and who was Reed?
Neither one. We went to the library. We got a book of very waspy names. And we picked the two that sounded like they'd work well together.
Because you guys didn't like say, Andrew's Bradford, definitely. His personality is definitely Bradford.
You know what? Actually, it's so interesting that now we're having fun talking about this. But when I first talked about how when my brother and I started a business, we named it Bradford and Reed because I was worried that if we gave it a .com sounding name, if I called up to make ad sales, people wouldn't take my calls. But I said, if I come up with a very legally name, something that sounded important like Bradford and Reed, customers would take my call and then I could pitch them and sell them. I thought when I released that, what if people think that was scammy? What if people hear that and they criticize me? And I did get criticism for it when I talked about it. But now it's become part of my story. It's become something that shows how creative I like to be about business, how determined I was when I had nothing. And you and I could have fun about it. And that's an example of how when you just take that risk that people are going to laugh at you, when you take that risk that something's not going to land, it could be worth it. It is worth it.
Yeah. See, I'm a complete nerd. I would have just said, yeah, I would have picked Bradford for myself just fully, you know, like I'd have like made up a whole name like Reginald Bradford III or something to go along with it. So where can people get a hold of you? I told everybody Mixergy.com, but where else can they find you?
That's pretty much the best way to do it. Go to Mixergy.com and you guys are resourceful. You can find me in so many other ways beyond that.
All right. So what's like one of your favorite interview to send people to? And I'll link it up.
You know what? There's one that I especially like, which is with Emmett Shear, the founder of Twitch TV. And the reason I love that is because he shows how talking to potential customers and finding their pain can help you figure out where that huge business success is. He called his customers, figured out where their pain was, and he built Twitch TV into an incredible success story.
All right. I'll do that. Fantastic. Hey, before we end the show, I'd like to give a little shout out to some iTunes reviews. I've gotten another great one here by Chris. I'm not even going to try to pronounce your name because you know I'm going to mess it up. So just go on to iTunes and you'll be able to see his last name. So Chris says, best podcast ever. 5 stars. Thank you very much, Chris. This is by far the best online business podcast out there. It's very inspiring, entertaining, and actionable. I remember my first listen through. I was on a bus across Poland, 800 kilometers, and listened for 14 hours straight. I couldn't wait to get off and start working. Unfortunately, it was the start of my holiday. You know when you're inspiring when people want to ditch their holidays thanks to you. I recommend downloading all the episodes. Not a single one failed to deliver insane value. Wow, I really appreciate that, Chris. Love that. That's great. I am glad you're getting value and taking action on that value. That's fantastic. So, if you're listening, please go out and give us an iTunes review. It helps the show rank higher in iTunes, which allows the show to create more impact in the world. And I'll definitely read out your review on the show. I want to give out one more shout out. And this one is to the new FAU that I've been recreating, the Foolish Training Program that's been in existence for nearly 2 years now. This is a complete overhaul and change in the way the education is delivered, because this is full-on entrepreneurship education, not some IM get money easy scheme out there. Foolish has always been about creating a real sustainable business, and I just want to give a little shout out because at the time of this recording, FAU is getting close to launch. We're going to reopen soon, and I would love it if you would join me in there and be able to build the skills that you need to create a successful business. If you're interested in finding out more about FAU, or depending on when you're listening to this, want to become an FAU member, just go on over to launch.foolishuniversity.com. That's launch.foolishuniversity.com. So that's enough of a plug. So everyone listening, I hope you've gotten some value out of this, or at least enough inspiration to keep going, to keep getting through the struggles, and keep working towards building the vision that you see the world needs. So until the next time,
enjoy your foolish adventure.
You've just listened to the Foolish Adventure Show with Tim Conley. To get more straight talk about making money online and building a successful internet business, go to foolishadventure.com. There, you can opt into the Freedom File newsletter. You'll also get access to the Foolish Guide to Launching Products video training module, over an hour and 20 minutes of business building knowledge that can generate tens of thousands of dollars for your new product. Enjoy your Foolish Adventure.
I like that I was able to express myself without feeling like you are going to see it as me disagreeing with your method. I like your method. And one of the reasons why I like your method is that it allowed me to talk about why I prefer an alternative method.
Yeah, I don't mind. I find that where I'm able to learn is in the parts where people don't agree. Because if everybody agrees, then you don't learn anything new. You can't get anything new. So our styles are completely different, but we both have like the same, or at least a similar goal is that we really want to make the world a better place. We think we can do it. And I think that's critically important for people to hear and to be able to go out and do it themselves.